of the Christ came through a vision. But as far as we know, this was never repeated. Like Mary Magdalene, he had to move beyond the Jesus consciousness to the authentic mystical perception, which was a non-sensuous awareness of the power of the risen Christ. The vision of Jesus was given in order that he be not considered less than the other apostles, all of whom who had known Jesus after the flesh. Why then did this understanding, this perception, this mystical awareness not remain and continue as the authentic expression of the Christian faith? Any religion is shaped by those by whom it is constituted, and inevitably it develops as a human institution. The authentic inner dimension of the Christian faith became at first subservient to, and then largely submerged by, a belief system, for the clear reason that this is where humanity was, and still largely is, at. Nevertheless, the Christian religion, by formulating a canon of scripture from the New Testament documents, maintained a verbal allegiance to the path of the mystic, allegiance to a Christocentric faith, a faith in the one in whom are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, a Christ both personal and cosmic. The difficulty of the mystic was from the very beginning the consciousness of oneness. For the mystical perception went beyond all dualism to rest only in absolute unity. For dualism exists only at the level of sensual perception. And reconciling this with evil was not easy. The Christian mystic truly believed that Christ had ascended far above all heavens that he might fill all things. And in the words of St. Paul, the mystic's concern was to seek those things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of the Father. Certainly, there is imagery here. Indeed, the whole New Testament is rich in heavenly imagery, for it both expresses and speaks to many levels of human awareness and experience. Yet, the apex of the Christ consciousness is described by St. Paul as imageless. Writing to the Christians at Corinth, he says of the consummation of all things, "Then shall the Son himself be subject to God, that God may be all and in all." This is described by Teilhard de Chardin as the mystic's dream. This consciousness of oneness, this experience of non-duality, quickly gave birth to conflict with the ecclesiastical authorities in the early church. And the tension between the path of knowledge and the path of faith has continued. And the belief systems of all the great religions are frequently felt threatened by the mystics. Nevertheless, many mystics managed to contain their mystical awareness within orthodox theological systems. And some had a clear understanding that the mystical and the theological represented two different levels of understanding. They had no real difficulty in reconciling the two. The vast majority of Catholic mystics were submissive to the theological framework of the Church and managed to give an interpretation of union with God which could be accommodated to strict orthodoxy. Even Eckhart, in his defence, defers to the Church and attempts to explain away his pantheism. St. Teresa simply bypassed the problem and gave it no attention. The more philosophically inclined sought to find a solution to the problem of non-duality and union which was compatible with Christian orthodoxy. St. John of the Cross approached it as follows, from the Ascent of Mount Carmel, Book 1, Chapter 1. Union is here interpreted not in terms of identity, but in terms of similarity of purpose. And he writes of that union and transformation of the soul in God, which is only then accomplished when there subsists the likeness which only love begets. For this reason shall this union be called the union of likeness, which takes place when the two wills, the will of God and the will of the souls, are conformed together, neither desiring aught repugnant to the other. I'll read that again. He writes of that union and transformation of the soul in God, which is only then accomplished when there subsists the likeness which only love begets. For this reason shall this union be called the union of likeness, which take place when the two wills, the will of God and the will of the soul, are conformed together, neither desiring aught repugnant to the other. Here then is still dualism, for there are two wills which become compatible. But it satisfied John of the Cross and presumably was not heretical in terms of orthodoxy. And here we find ourselves caught up in the question of what is real, the question still very much debated in our time. To the physical body, the physical world is real. To the emotional body, the world of emotions and all that this constitutes is real. To that organ of perception within the human being which perceives spiritual reality, only God is real. It is at this level of understanding, perception, awareness, seeing, that there is no duality. With the evolution of consciousness, which has taken place since the time of St. John of the Cross, and indeed since the founding of Christian Science, which denies any reality to anything but God and the good, and perhaps even since the day of Joel Goldsmith and similar writers, it may be that we are now entering into a new understanding of the problem. At this point, let us return briefly to something we looked at in the last session. That is, the fact that there is one authentic mystical consciousness. That this consciousness is common to all mystics of all time, but is interpreted and expresses itself in a diversity of cultural and indeed theological forms. These differences, these variable factors are intellectual and emotional. The intellectual, as is clear, accounts for the differences between the religions. Let us look at the emotional expression of the mystical consciousness as it expresses itself in a distinctively Christian way. And here we find that, as distinct from Buddhist mysticism, where there is no thought of a personal God, there is frequently intense and emotionally charged imagery. Take, for example, the following, which are characteristic of St. John of the Cross. Flame of love, wonderful love shed in the heart, the beloved, the bride, the bridegroom, father, son, God's child, etc., etc. All these terms are interpretations, articulations of. They're not the experience itself. Of course, the intellectual and emotional aspects frequently intermingle, and the former influences the latter. For example, the belief that Christ died for us undoubtedly influences the emotions of many. We need also to be aware that the emotional reaction is different not only with different cultures, but with different individuals within the same culture. For example, though St. Teresa of Avila talked in extravagant terms about burning love, being drunken with love, and the like, we find nothing at all of this in Meister Eckhart. The emotional tone of the mystics varies all the way from the calm serenity of the Buddha or Eckhart to what may be described as the hyper-emotionalism of Teresa. Eckhart expressly rejects hyper-emotionalism as part of the mystical experience. He refers to storms of emotion and asserts that they belong to the physical part of our nature and that the summit of the soul, wherein the mystical union takes place, towers high above them. Nevertheless, the emphasis on love in the sense of both a mutual love between God and man and of man's love toward his fellows is especially characteristic of Christian mysticism. To such an extent that it's sufficient to distinguish its flavour, if not the essence, from other mysticism. That which comes nearest to it is that of the Buddhist compassion for all living things. There is, incidentally, nothing within the Christian gospel which is explicitly comparable to the Buddhist extension of love and compassion to animals, though it is implicit enough for it to become explicit in a St. Francis. In comparing Christian mystical expression with that of other traditions, it is true to say that more than in any other religion, the Christian mystic emphasizes the love of God to humanity and humanity's love for God, and love between human beings as an essential part of the mystical consciousness. This, however, requires some qualification, for if the annihilation of the self means anything, it means a total giving up of the right to oneself and a surrender to God. And whatever the language used to describe this, it would be a contradiction in terms to say that this surrender does not contain all that the Christian means by love. What then is new about mysticism today? The new factor, which has undoubtedly become apparent since the upheavals of the 60s and 70s, is that today's mysticism is as never before reluctant to be anchored to any one dogmatic statement of faith. And this undoubtedly is one of the main characteristics of the new mysticism. For the myth that only a correct belief pattern can produce a valid mysticism has, in the judgment of many, been exploded. Divided Christendom itself bears undivided testimony to a mystical awareness which recognizes no theological barriers, for there are Catholic and there are Protestant mystics. Indeed, there have been mystics within all the Christian groupings throughout history. Direct knowledge of the truth, which itself issues forth in charity, finds its origin not in patterns of faith, but in knowledge of the divine love. And lest this be dismissed as anti-intellectual and subjective, we should consider a second of its characteristics. That is, the convergence of today's mystical awareness with developments within Western scientific thought. For the modern scientist is increasingly reluctant to assert that truth can be encapsulated in a set of immutable propositions. The scientist is also aware that not all reality can be intellectually discerned or reduced to mathematical formulae. The occult explosion of recent years has revealed areas where laws operate which are beyond the capacity of traditional scientific methods to investigate or evaluate. conferences for scientists and mystics proliferate, and there is a mutual recognition of increasingly common ground in a search to discover and understand those laws which govern all life. Scientific investigation and mystical awareness are seen to be moving in a developing harmony. We stated earlier that the mystic is aware of the true nature of the world, and this awareness is today assuming new dimensions. For modern mystics live, move, and have their being on a planet that is rapidly developing a one-world consciousness. In their awareness, therefore, of the unity and oneness of all things, mystics cannot remain indifferent to movements political, economic, and ecological. The essential unity of which they are so confidently aware is everywhere manifesting at every level of human activity, demolishing the barriers which have long separated human beings from one another. And the implications of the mystical experience are now being worked out in relation to the future of the human being on this planet. In the past, Christian mysticism has often been accused of elitism and of constituting an exclusive club, membership of which has been the privilege of a few, and these mostly of the intelligentsia and the spiritually advanced. The criticism has not been entirely unmerited, for unlike the mystics of Buddhism, Hinduism, and Islam, those of the Western Christian Church have not been drawn from amongst those commonly regarded as the masses. This is no longer true. Today's starting point on the path is found frequently to be the acceptance of the disciplines of guided silence, where consciousness is trained to focus at the still center, not in the study of mysticism in its classical forms. Such training, in the context of a like-minded group, constitutes the doing of the truth, to which all may learn simply and quickly to apply themselves. So, let us reflect briefly on the meaning of such application. But first of all, let us be quiet together. The path of the mystic, the way of mystic awareness, begins, moves forward, and finds its fulfillment in utter simplicity. There are no experiences to be sought out, yearned for, or even thought about. There are no great heights to be self-consciously scaled. There is no one to be emulated. No thing to be desired other than God. And even here, it may be necessary to offload our projected images of God. The Omega invocation approaches the God reality as light, love, and power. the way, the truth, and the life. The Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Yet it is sufficient to focus simply on union with the Source, for everything is contained in that one word, Source. And for this union, we seek to create space, place, and recognition. Place, space, and recognition. A recognition that within ourselves there is potentially, waiting to be recognized, this space and place. Here is the very point of beginning, where I am now. Where I am now. Is there then no price to be paid for this tremendous union, this communion with the Source? Yes, indeed there is. Ultimately, it is all that I have, all that I am, all that I have, all that I am. But it begins with whatever I am ready to offer. Whatever I am ready to offer. And remember, here is mystery. It is God moving in me, prompting me. God moving in me, prompting me. The paradox of God searching for himself. God searching for himself. All is my responsibility, yet all is of God. And in the stillness of a quiet mind, this tremendous activity, this searching out, this divine activity operates. But I cannot always have a quiet mind. No. But I can begin to build, to create, to establish a pattern during those periods, however brief, that I do have. And remember, there is only now and the possibility of the present moment. There is only now and the possibility of the present moment. Your quiet mind at this very moment, your receptive mind, your focusing of attention and will is the great seedbed for growth. The very rhythm of your breathing at this moment is confirming the breath of God breathing in and through you. The very breath of God breathing in and through you. And the breath of God gives
life.
Breathe on me, breath of God. Fill me with life anew, that I may love what thou dost love and do what thou wouldst do. Breathe on me, breath of God, until my heart is pure, until with thee I will one will to do and to endure. Breathe on me, breath of God, till I am wholly thine, until this earthly part of me glows with the fire divine. Breathe on me, breath of God, so shall I never die, but live with thee the perfect life of thine eternity.